Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a call today by a group of U.S. senators for the Congress and the White House to act to stop Wall Street speculators from driving up the price of gas. Senator Bernie Sanders will fill us in on what he and his colleagues are calling for, while the rest of the Congress, the White House, and the press remain silent on this issue while blaming everything else but Wall Street for the pain at the pump. Then we will speak with Alec McGillis, who is the New Republic's chief correspondent for the 2012 campaign. He wrote the cover story in the New Republic's April issue, The Big Split, Why the Hedge Fund World Loved Obama in 2008 and Viscerally Despises Him Today. We will discuss why Wall Street is funding Obama's opposition and the extent to which they are manipulating the economy to hurt his re-election chances. Then we'll go to Paris and speak with François Dalacon, who is the foreign correspondent with the French daily newspaper La Croix. He is the paper's former foreign news editor and has covered the Middle East extensively. We will look into the police standoff in Toulouse, France, where Mohamed Merah, wanted for the murder of three French paratroopers, a rabbi, and three Jewish children, is holed up under siege. We will examine what is known about this suspected assassination and how much his claim to be with Al-Qaeda is credible. Then finally, we'll be joined by the head of the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys, David Lebain, who will try to find out more about Florida's Stand Your Ground law and similar laws that 32 other states have adopted. We'll look into how it is shielding the killer of a 17-year-old boy who has not been prosecuted for what is becoming increasingly apparent was a cold-blooded murder fueled by racism and delusions of a wannabe cop. And joining us now is Senator Bernie Sanders, who was elected to the United States Senate in 2006, representing Vermont after having served 16 years in the House of Representatives. He is the longest serving independent member of Congress in American history. And today he and Senators Richard Blumenthal, Ben Cardin, Al Franken, and Amy Klobuchar held a press conference calling for an end to the Wall Street speculation driving up the price of gas. Welcome to Background Briefing, Senator Sanders.
Good to be with you.
And the message that you've been getting out for some time, actually, for months now you've been talking about this. I've spoken to Michael Greenberger, who was the former head of trading and markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Association, some months ago about the rising price of gas. Fidel Geit, considered one of the leading experts on oil and gas markets, he says that 30% of the price at the pump is due to Wall Street speculation. Why this resistance? I know you've been rattling the bell here, but what explains the resistance in the press for seeing the obvious?
Well, that's a good question. And I think certainly here in the Congress, it has a lot to do with the power of our good friends on Wall Street. You know, we are in the midst of this horrible recession right now because of the greed and illegal behavior of Wall Street. And these guys don't stop. They don't stop. And what's going on right now is, despite the fact that the supply of oil today is higher than it was 3 years ago when the price of gas was $1.94 a gallon, and demand is lower than any time since 1997, what we're seeing is a huge spike in oil and gas prices. And I think, as you've indicated, what common sense kind of suggests, that if the answer is not supply and demand, we have more supply, less demand, that has everything to do with the fact that over 80% of the oil futures market is controlled not by people who actually use the oil, fuel dealers, truckers, airline companies, but it's controlled by Wall Street speculators led by Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and other companies like that.
Well, it's not as if we haven't seen this movie before, Senator Sanders. Back in 2008, when oil was $147 a barrel, shortly after that, CBS's 60 Minutes did an expose saying it was the Goldman Sachs's and the J.P. Morgan Chase's and other big banks that control more oil than Exxon ever dreamed of, and they had these tankers going around in circles full of oil.
No, absolutely. And you know, in addition to that, you have companies like ExxonMobil themselves acknowledging and saying speculation is causing significant increases in the price of gas and oil. Interestingly enough, Goldman Sachs indicated that they thought that excessive speculation was rising the price at the pumping station about 56 cents for a gallon of gas. I think that's conservative. but you got the St. Louis Fed. So I think you got all kinds of groups and organizations and economists who now recognize that excessive speculation, that when 80% of the oil futures market is controlled by speculators, it is not a question of supply and demand. Now, your question, I think, is a good question. Where is the Congress? Why haven't we acted on it? Have we seen this movie before? And the answer is, yeah, we have. It's getting to be kind of boring. I can tell you that last week, about 10 of us met with Gary Gensler, who is the chairman of the agency that is supposed to deal with excessive speculation. It's called the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. And we had a long chat with him. I should also tell you that in the language of Dodd-Frank, the financial reform bill passed a couple of years ago, there were specific provisions telling the CFTC and Mr. Gensler that they had to end excessive speculation in oil. They haven't done it. And what this bill that we've introduced today is about is no longer giving them the option. It's telling them that they must use the emergency provisions that they have to end excessive speculation.
Well, we know from the previous commissioner, Commissioner Dunn, who was a Democrat appointed by George W. Bush, that he voted with the Republicans and that there was a cry for position. There's been a cry for position limits for some time to end this excessive speculation and allow these markets to function as they should be, which is for the end users of the product, not for the Wall Street speculators. He went on to become a lobbyist. I believe the Goldman Sachs have sued against special position limits. And Gensler comes from Goldman Sachs, although I'm told that he's not, that he's actually showing a little bit of concern for this consumer. What's your sense of it, Senator Sanders?
I don't see the sense of urgency in his office that there should be. Look, I come from a rural state, and many of the people in my state make 10, 12, 14 bucks an hour. They travel long distances to work in their cars, and when gas goes up to $4 a gallon, which is where it's going to in Vermont, that's just taking money that people don't have right out of their wallets. Furthermore, you know, as a nation, we are struggling to get out of this terrible recession. And high oil prices are making it that much more difficult. Do I believe that Mr. Gensler perceives this sense of urgency and is determined to do everything that he can to break up this excessive speculation? I don't see that. No, I don't. That's why this legislation is necessary.
And he has the power to act, and he's just simply not doing it.
He has, well, for a start, he was supposed to have acted 14 months ago, according to the language in Dodd-Frank. That's what he was told to do. He hasn't done that. Mm. But right now, of course, he has the power to, in a sense, declare an emergency, use his emergency powers, and to act forcefully. Is there an emergency? Yeah, I think there is an emergency. And it's an emergency when people who don't have the money are paying far more for gas than they should. It's an emergency when this struggling economy is trying to make some gains, and we're not doing it to the degree that we should because of high oil prices. So that's what I think he should do. I think he should use his emergency powers. I think he should go forward on aggressive position limits. I think he should go forward on margin requirements. And I think if you could do that, you can end the excessive speculation, and I suspect you're going to drive oil and gas prices down.
Well, Senator Sanders, there's no question that this is becoming a central political issue in this campaign year. And some time back, the Republican head of the House, John Boehner, said that gas prices could be a winning political issue for the Republicans in this election. And I'm just wondering, we understand the president in approving the at least the southern part of the Keystone XL pipeline is probably reacting to that kind of pressure. But is there a possibility that the Wall Street people who, according to the new cover article in the New Republic, why the hedge fund world loved Obama in 2008 and viscerally despise him today, indicates that they've turned against him? And if Gensler, who comes out of Goldman Sachs, and if Wall Street are profiting from the American people, gouging them every time they go to the gas pump, and this is hurting Obama and, I guess, by extension, the Democrats, is there any reason to feel that this has become a political issue in that conspiratorial sense that I'm suggesting?
Well, I don't see it that way. What I see is obviously high oil prices is something that the Republicans are going to want to blame Obama for. I think that's simply inaccurate. Their views were very different when oil prices went up under President Bush. What I do believe is that it is absolutely appropriate for the president to deal with the speculation issue. He's talked about it a little bit, but nowhere near to the degree that he should have. And I think he must be prepared to take on his Wall Street friends, who I gather no longer like him terribly much. But be that as it may, I mean, forget the politics of this thing. It makes no sense that oil prices are spiking, not because of supply and demand, but because of excessive speculation. You got to deal with that for the economy. You got to deal with that. And I think what the president has got to do is make sure that we act aggressively, make sure that Mr. Gensler understands the importance of this issue, and let's see if we can lower gas and oil prices.
But if the head of the CTFC, who's supposed to have oversight and supposed to be dealing with this, is sitting on his hands, and he's a Wall Streeter, what's the explanation? Is it just that they're making money?
I don't want to get personal with
right.
Mr. Gensler. I don't, you know.
Right.
As it happens, I put a hold on his nomination. I voted against him.
Right.
But, you know, I don't want to psychoanalyze the situation. Bottom line is, they've got to act. And if he doesn't act, maybe he shouldn't be in that position, period.
Well, just in closing, I wanted to touch on the Jobs Act, if I could, because I've had Simon Johnson on a couple of days ago screaming from the rooftop that it's the most colossal mistake of historical proportions. And Bill Black, the former prosecutor for the savings and loan disaster, says it's an open invitation for fraud. He called the act an atrocity. I know you're on the side trying to stop it. Where does it stand?
Where it stands is the Republicans in the House have passed it. The Democrats today brought forth an amendment to try to improve it. There's a goal to try to improve it. The $64 question is whether this piece of legislation can be improved in any significant degree to make it worthwhile. I have my serious doubts about that.
But my understanding is that those that could vote for amendments are required to get to the 60 threshold of the filibuster through threshold. And it's beginning to look like a device where those that object to it get to vote, but the vote's meaningless.
Yeah, that could be the case.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Senator Sanders.
Thank you very much.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I was just speaking then with Senator Bernie Sanders, who was elected to the United States Senate in 2006, representing Vermont after having served 16 years in the House of Representatives. He is the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history, and today he and Senators Richard Blumenthal, Ben Cardin, Al Franken, and Amy Klobuchar held a press conference calling for an end to the Wall Street speculation driving up the price of gas. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the author of the cover article in the April issue of The New Republic, The Big Split, Why the Hedge Fund World Loved Obama in 2008 and Viscerally Despises Him Today.
Corny, they follow suit. Advanced, they will swallow truth. Hollow, shallow, ball of cute. A white shit, they in hot pursuit. Clones on phones, sniffed out drones. Never made they wrong. I know to make they wealth, they'll break they self. All paper, stand for paper. Music capers, love they haters. Desire to jealous, body lovers. Crying fronters, lies and cover-ups. Self-promoters, slippery slopers. Speculate, hella hate. Be full, steady eye.
I don't love you anymore. It's just that simple. No, 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 not like before. Said it's a shame, dirty shame, yeah. We can't work it out. No, not this time. We can't be together.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alec MacGillis, a New Republic writer serving as the magazine's chief correspondent for the 2012 campaign. Previously, he spent 5 years at the Washington Post covering politics and domestic policy and also wrote for the Baltimore Sun. He wrote the cover article in the April issue of the New Republic, The Big Split, Why the Hedge Fund World Loved Obama in 2008 and Viscerally Despises Him Today. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alec MacGillis.
Thanks for having me.
And I guess, could you answer that question? Well, I know you've written a whole article,
right.
A lengthy one to do so, right. But what's a brief answer to that question?
I'm not sure there is a brief answer, but it's a real mystery that I set out to try to answer here. I mean, this is, I see it as one of the more interesting subplots of this administration. You have these these guys, these masters of the universe, who just really loved Barack Obama back in 2008 and felt a real kind of connection with him, kind of saw him as somehow like them. And then over the last few years, he's lost them. He's lost most of them. And some of them are now spending very, very heavily on the other side, sending million-dollar checks to the Republicans, and are just deeply, deeply angry at him. And so the question is, what's going on here, right? And these guys are still doing quite well for themselves, very well for themselves. The top 40 hedge funds made $13 billion last year. That's the top 40 managers made $13 billion combined last year. Their taxes have not gone up. They've barely gone up over the last few years. And his rhetoric, Obama's rhetoric toward them, has not been all that harsh. You know, a lot of people wish that his rhetoric toward Wall Street would have been harsher. So, you know, what is it? Why are they so deeply upset at him? And so I try to answer this question. I talk to people in this world, and what I came up with was that you know, it's a combination of things. There are some sort of practical, substantial policy things that these guys were upset about, that most of which have to do with tax policy, and I can get into that later if you'd like. But then a lot of it did come around to the rhetoric and that the president's been using, and which is puzzling, right? Because the rhetoric seems to us to be fairly mild. He made some references here and there to fat cat bankers. He talks about hedge fund managers taking advantage of tax loopholes here and there. But in general, his rhetoric's been pretty mild. But what I finally came around to thinking was that, as mild as his rhetoric has been, that these guys may have been picking up on something that is actually perhaps sort of real, which is that this president, who they respected so much and admired so much and felt this connection with a few years ago, actually doesn't think very much of them and doesn't really think very much of the choices they've made and the career choices that they've made and of this life that they've pursued, this life of extreme wealth and extreme success, which a life that these financiers, these managers have managed over the years to justify to themselves as something that's quite valuable and important and noble for society. And you had this president who came along, who they felt this bond with, who has made clear here and there and sort of just expressed, you know, in his sort of mild, subtle way, that he just doesn't really think that there's all that much value to what they do. And they've had a really, really, really hard time with that judgment.
Well, that may be a judgment that the majority of the American people feel, perhaps even the 99% feel towards these representatives of the 1%. Again, I'm speaking with Alec McGillis, a New Republic writer serving as the magazine's chief correspondent for the 2012 campaign. He has written the cover article in the April issue of the New Republic, The Big Split, Why the Hedge Fund World Loved Obama in 2008 and Viscerally Despises Him Today. And you start your article in May of 2007 with Barack Obama wowing the hedge fund managers at an event at the Museum of Modern Art in New York hosted by Goldman Sachs. One of the people there asked him bluntly, if you're elected president, what would you do to the taxes of the people in this room? Obama fired back, I'll raise them, which, you know, most people think that wouldn't be endearing, but they liked his brash quality and the qualities that you've just talked about. They clearly don't like him today, but I was trying to ask Senator Sanders, and he sort of ducked the question, is there a political question here? Is there some vengeance here? Is there some payback? And is gouging the price of gasoline a part of a plan, or is it just business as usual?
That's a good question, and I'm no expert on the oil markets, and so I couldn't even say for sure how much of these price spikes are speculation driven. To the extent that there is speculation going on, I would venture that it's being driven by plain, you know, business motivation.
Old-fashioned greed.
exactly, old-fashioned greed, less than, you know, the political motivation, you know, knowing that these prices are hurting the president.
Right. But what about the extent to which everybody on the left ritually blames Obama's choice of Geithner and Summers for everything. Either they think that Wall Street foisted these guys on him, or he made the terrible choice of choosing them. And you're saying something quite different,
right?
That they actually liked Obama. So it's not so much about Summers and Geithner. It's about a love affair gone wrong with Wall Street and Obama.
Right. It's exactly. He Obama's caught in this incredible bind because you're right. On the left, he got a lot of flack for going with these guys who were very tight with Wall Street. And then at the same time, the fact that he picked Tim Geithner to be Treasury Secretary earned him very little lasting credibility or lasting favor with Wall Street itself and with these hedge fund guys. And it's really, this is something that really does seem to go beyond policy. I mean, it's really more perplexing with the hedge funds than it is with the banks, because the banks, the big banks, you can sort of understand somewhat better why they are upset at Obama and not giving him any money now, because there's this real resentment over the bailouts and Dodd-Frank. So there's this feeling that they know that they got bailed out by Obama. They're resentful about that. You know, they know that he thinks they should be more grateful. He pushed for Dodd-Frank, which really has, to some extent, you know, it's not as strong as it could have been, obviously, but it has, there are signs that it is crimping the bank's profits. So you can get it a little bit more that there's this split with the banks. With the hedge funds, it's harder to understand, because Dodd-Frank does not touch the hedge funds as much. They might even benefit from some parts of the law. And they also just felt more of a connection with Obama back in 08 than the banks did. So you just wonder, what is it with them? And that's why, again, I come around to this notion that it's more something that's more personal. It has more to do with values and perceptions of values and perceptions of sort of their personal worth, really. There was this big fight. There was a fight over taxes, and I'll just explain that briefly what that involved. You may have heard there's this thing called the hedge fund loophole, which is this pretty outrageous loophole which allows
carried interest, right?
Exactly, hedge fund managers and private equity managers to take the money that they get for managing money, the fees that they collect for managing money, and have that money taxed as capital gains instead of as earned income, when in fact it's just their compensation for the work they do, and they get a tax at 15%. When if it were taxed as ordinary income, it would be
right. Or if they get any tax at all because of the carried interest, where they can spread it over years and years.
Right, exactly. They play games.
Right, and that's what Mitt Romney's been doing, right, with his money.
Right, exactly. Romney's profited from that, and you know, a lot of these guys actually recognize that the hedge fund loophole is pretty inexcusable. And but what really upset them was that when the Democrats started talking about trying to close the loophole, they went a step further, and they realized that if they just closed the loophole, that there'd be another way for these guys to get around it. It's sort of complicated, but basically they could get around it by selling stakes in their firms to another party, which would allow them to basically continue having their income taxed as capital gains rather than at the higher rate. And so to keep this new loophole from being created, the Democrats were going to basically have passed a law saying that if these investment managers sold stakes in their firms, part of the profits from those sales would be taxed as ordinary income and not capital gains. And this, the managers just found totally outrageous. And this was the legislation that prompted this one guy, Steve Schwarzman, to declare that it was like Hitler taking Poland. They saw this as just total, you know, appropriation of their hard-earned capital. So there was that fight over taxes, but I really do believe that the broader thing that has really upset them is this sense that they've gotten from the president that he just doesn't respect them very much and hold them in very high esteem. And, you know, it's that old saying, you know, you can buy anything with your billions of dollars, but you can't buy respect or reputation. And so they it matters a great deal to these gentlemen what the world thinks of them. And yes. and to have the president make clear that he doesn't think very much of them, I think, caused them great grief.
Well, one of your sources, of course, is Bill Daley in your article, Alec McGillis, who just was up to recently President Obama's chief of staff. And he talks about how there was so much, you know, just like the rest of the country was in a kind of euphoric mood when he was elected, and how that has changed to this kind of what you describe as how they viscerally despise him today. Just in closing, he is throwing a bone to them that with the Jobs Act, which Simon Johnson and others say is an open invitation for fraud. Is that going to win any brownie points with him?
I kind of doubt it, because, again, so many of there's so many things that he has done that have upset people on the left that have seen like have been seen as sops to Wall Street, and these have not kept him from being loathed by some of them. I should say in closing that there's a chance that some of these guys will come sort of crawling back toward the Democratic camp, toward Obama.
If they think he's going to be reelected,
right? If they think he's going to be reelected, and which will be a little awkward for some of them, but some of them might try to do that. But I think for most of them, they are just that angry. I mean, one of the guys I focus on, Ken Griffin, head of Citadel, this huge hedge fund in Chicago, who gave a lot to Obama last time and is now split with him, he just in the papers today said that he'd given another $100,000 to Mitt Romney's super PAC. So some of them are they're done with Obama.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Alec McGillis.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Alec McGillis, who is a New Republic writer serving as the magazine's chief correspondent for the 2012 campaign. Previously, he spent 5 years at the Washington Post covering politics and domestic policy, and also wrote for the Baltimore Sun. He has the cover article in the April issue of the New Republic, The Big Split: Why the Hedge Fund World Loved Obama in 2008 and Viscerally Despises Him Today. And joining us now from Paris is François d'Alençon, who's a foreign correspondent with the French daily La Croix. He's formerly the foreign news editor with La Croix and has covered the Middle East extensively. Welcome to Background Briefing, François d'Alençon.
Good evening.
What is the latest, your understanding, François, of what is happening in Toulouse, where the killer of three French soldiers and a rabbi and three Jewish children is holed up under siege?
Yeah, Mohamed Mehran, this is the name of the man believed to be the gunman, and he's alone in a building in Toulouse, surrounded by police. We don't know whether the police will succeed in getting him surrendering, or they will have to give an assault. I guess we'll know by tomorrow morning.
So I take it that the Interior Ministry troops have said that they want to take him alive. Is that what you understand?
Yeah, the Ministry of Interior said that he was on TV this evening, and he said that we want him to be judged by the French justice system, and so we want him alive.
But he is supposed to be heavily armed, right?
Well, he is, but he is, yeah. But the negotiations, and he has been talking a lot with the police throughout the day. Seems to be very talkative. He's telling a lot of things to the police. He has said why he wanted to do this, what was, you know, he had been motivated by the fate of the Palestinians, the French military presence in Afghanistan, the France's ban on the full veil. And he even said that he wanted to surrender by the late afternoon, which has not occurred yet. But so there is a constant going back and forth between him and the police through the walkie-talkie system.
Well, again, I'm speaking with François d'Alençon, who is a foreign correspondent with the French daily La Croix. He's a former foreign news editor and has covered the Middle East extensively. And the suspect in this case, Mohamed Mehran, is a 23-year-old French citizen of Algerian descent. He's apparently visited Pakistan and claims to have gone to Al-Qaeda training camps. He was also, I believe, arrested in Afghanistan by the Afghan police. How much did the French authorities have a profile on this fellow already. One would think.
Well, he was being, followed and very closely monitored by the French police since he came back from Pakistan. The last time was, I think, in 2011, because he went first to Afghanistan and then did a second trip to Pakistan and tribal areas. But he has also a criminal record for non-terrorist crimes in France and spent more than a year in jail. And apparently this time, as very often it is the case for this type of jihadist, he spent a long time in jail and became more politically motivated throughout this time in jail, maybe through people he met in prison. But this guy has a very interesting profile in the sense that he was not seen as a religious, very religious-oriented kind of person, but more a sort of juvenile delinquent, very fond of cars and
nightclubs
and going out and enjoying his time. And so it's unlikely profile, but at the same time, he was not an unknown quantity for the police. He was really on the list of people closely monitored by the French services.
François d'Alençon, he killed a paratrooper and trapped him by advertising to sell a scooter. And this French paratrooper, Imad Ibn Zaitan, he lured into a meeting. Now, killing a fellow Muslim, is that damaging his claims to be? First of all, you mentioned earlier that he said he had killed the rabbi and the Jewish children to avenge the deaths of Palestinian children. The Palestinian president has come out and said that the Palestinian Authority is sick of criminals claiming political acts on behalf of the Palestinian people, and he's roundly condemned what this fellow's doing. How is it playing in France, which has a substantial Muslim population, the fact that he killed this French paratrooper?
Well, obviously, there are several points to make. First, for the French Muslim community, this is really terrible news, because as all the main representative of the community tried to say today, this doesn't represent the Muslim religion at all, and they were all condemning the action, obviously. But I mean, there is a fear, obviously, among the French Muslim population and community, that because of this terrorist act, there is really a sort of stigmatization of the entire community. And especially, and this is my second point, especially that we are in an electoral campaign. We have a presidential election coming on April 22nd. So it's less, it's 1 month away. And so in that kind of situation and political situation, this latest event is bound to be exploited politically by, for example, the extreme right, the National Front, already criticizing the authorities for being too laxist, not having arrested this guy before he committed his crime. So this is a very polarized situation where everybody is trying to capitalize for its own sake.
François d'Alençon, again, foreign correspondent with the French daily La Croix and the former foreign news editor who has covered the Middle East extensively. Given the French political season, which, we have a much longer one here, I regret to say, goes on in for years, what's happening with Sarkozy, in the sense that he recently made that statement that France was overcrowded, implying there were too many foreigners? But my understanding is that more recently, his speech in relation to this current current crisis and the death of the Jewish children and the rabbi and the soldiers has to some extent redeemed himself. Tell me about how Sarkozy is handling this.
Well, obviously, President Sarkozy is trying to show statesmanship in this very particular event. And so, first of all, he stopped campaigning and today attended the funerals of the three French soldiers in the south of France, in the town of Montauban. And it's obviously could be said on one hand that playing on national unity and appealing to the French public not to indulge in any kind of, you know, scapegoating condemnation, sure, or stigmatization of the Muslim community. So he's trying to, I think, play the role of, you know,
the elder statesman, the
statements above the fray. Right. This is one, and on the same time, obviously, the campaign will resume very quickly, maybe as soon as tomorrow. And so it's very hard today to predict how this particular event will play on the voters. It's a bit too early to tell. You know, some people might say Sarkozy was built all his political career on, you know, being tough on crime, being tough on security issues, you know, being the former Ministry of Interior, and being tough on crime and terror has always been his
strong suit. Yes.
Yeah, and so it might also, you know, it can play both ways. Nobody knows exactly as to how this particular one will play on April 22nd.
So, given that Mohamed Merah, the alleged killer of the three French soldiers and the rabbi and the three Jewish children, who was under siege, surrounded in the city of Toulouse, you say he's very talkative, and he's been talking. Has he been talking to the press, or is this talking to the police? How do we know?
No, talking to the police, exclusively.
But they're releasing what he's saying, apparently. You're saying that he apparently has claimed to be a member of Al-Qaeda.
Being a member of Al-Qaeda, anybody can claim to be a member of Al-Qaeda. It happens to that, you know, the link with the Al-Qaeda network has to be documented. The fact is that he did two trips, one in Pakistan, tribal areas, one in Afghanistan, 2010, 2011. But apparently he did all that on his own. And at the moment, there is no evidence that there is a group or other people behind this attack and behind the killings. He apparently is a loner, and as we call it here, he's kind of, we call it Salafist jihadist, meaning that became more politicized after spending a year in jail. So, but it's a bit too early to say, you know, that he was on a mission contracted, you know, or assigned by some, you know, Al-Qaeda structure in the tribal areas.
Sure.
You know, he's claimed, but the evidence is not there.
Well, Al-Qaeda is such an organization that anybody can claim to be
exactly
a member, and he does sound like a bit of an Al-Qaeda wannabe, to use an American expression. And he also, you mentioned that he likes fast cars and nightclubs, and that certainly doesn't fit the profile of a Salafist. He did mention what he was motivated by the laws to ban the burqas in France. Just in closing, let me ask you about one. What was the French Muslims' response to Sarkozy's recent remarks about France being overcrowded, and two, this fellow, as I said, he's trying to appeal to try to justify his actions in political terms, and he's doing this on the behalf of the Palestinian children.
Yeah.
The Palestinian head of the Palestinian Authority has said, no, we don't believe this. This guy's a criminal. And it sounds like he's also trying to ingratiate himself with the French Muslim community and wrap himself in the issue of the burqa. So two questions. One, what has been the response to Sarkozy's remark about the country being overcrowded? And two, is there any sympathy for this man amongst, in terms of this issue that he's raised about the burqas and the veiling?
No, I must say I don't think there is any sympathy among the EU, you know, the mainstream Muslim community. I mean, the so-called Salafists are, and especially the Salafist jihadists, are a really marginal and very small population in France. Most of the Muslims, most of the French Muslims are, not very much politicized, not very much into any kind of Islamist groups. So for the average French Muslim, this is really a bad thing because this guy acted as he's more like a loner, he's more like a disenfranchised kind of juvenile delinquent, and the equation between, you know, Islam and terror and, the stigmatization of the Muslims is a big issue here. And this is the main fear among the Muslims. The second aspect I should mention is there is an underlying issue, as you probably know, that most of the Muslim youth, or at least a big number of Muslim youth, are unemployed, living in suburbs, sort of ghetto suburbs. And, of course, there is a growing number of those people who are attracted either militant organization, I'm not saying a jihadist, I'm saying by the, let's say, Muslim Brotherhood, and there is a lack of political representation for the Muslim population in the French political institution, and this lack of political representation is obviously a fertile ground for any kind of, group or Islamic propaganda.
Just in closing, though, it would seem to me that if this goes badly for Sarkozy, and say there's a terrible shootout and it's a big disaster, it surely will help the right wing, Le Pen's people, right? They're already
well. Yes and no. It's a complicated situation because if Marine Le Pen, the head of the National Front and a candidate for the presidency, if she's seen as exploiting the whole situation too much, it might also backfire on her. And, you know, for the time being, trying to benefit from the situation for any politician is a bit risky. And accusing for example, the French authorities, the police, or the French government of being too, not having prevented the attacks or and the killings, using the whole situation might also backfire. So I am not sure whether she will be able, the National Front will be able to capitalize on this.
Thank you very much for joining us here today, François d'Alençon.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with François d'Alençon, who's a foreign correspondent with the French daily La Croix. He's a former foreign news editor and has covered the Middle East extensively for La Croix. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the head of the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys about the Stand Your Ground law in Florida that allowed the murder of Trayvon Martin. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Lebon, who is the president and CEO of the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys, a national association representing elected and deputy or assistant prosecutors and city attorneys. He was previously the executive director of the California District Attorneys Association. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Lebon.
Well, thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me on your show.
And the law that appears to be shielding Mr. Zimmerman from prosecution down in Florida, the Stand Your Ground law, similar versions of it apparently are in 32 states in the country. And your association, which has members of about 1,000 prosecutors, that you oppose these laws, and apparently you said that what they don't solve problems and tie the hands of prosecutors.
Absolutely, our membership feels very strongly that this is a bad direction to take the law. What it's trying to call it is a castle doctrine or a stand your ground, but it's quite an expansion from the common law duties.
And I take it, even though you would think that the national group of prosecutors and district attorneys would have some political weight, I take it you are up against the National Rifle Association?
Well, this has very much been a state by state. And as you mentioned, it's gone through 32 states. But yes, not only a national group, but as well as the many different state associations have been unable to stop it. Obviously, Florida being the one in discussion in 2005.
And in the case of Florida, this appears to be, whether it's, as you've said, in more egregious forms, it appears to be giving criminals immunity. I understand that there has been an enormous uptick in the number of justifiable homicides reported. They've skyrocketed since the law went into effect in Florida in 2005.
Yeah, that's my understanding as well. What I understand is prior to 2005, they were averaging about 12 per year, and now I believe it's 33. So that's an awful lot of folks being killed.
So what can be done? I mean, obviously, a lot of people are now wondering how somebody that appears to be the aggressor in this situation can claim themselves to be the victim. And in a 17-year-old boy with no prior criminal record, no gang associations, he was just returning from the market, apparently, with Skittles and an iced tea, that he could be shot dead in such a way. It's really appalled a lot of people throughout the country, and we certainly haven't heard the end of it.
I wouldn't think this is the end of it, and this is exactly what we have been saying is the dangers of doing expanding the right of self-defense to areas beyond the home and beyond situations where there's an imminent threat to your family. Again, as prosecutors, we have no quarrel at all about what is referred to as castle doctrine or protect your castle. What the concerns become is when you extend it beyond there and it leads to a situation like this, where there is no question this was an intentional killing, yet because of their statute with immunity, there is no crime. Usually legislation tracks cases, and this piece of legislation or this movement of legislation didn't appear to track that there were cases where, you know, homeowners had been prosecuted for murder because they shot an intruder. Instead, it appeared to be a push in public policy to expand the bounds of self-defense and not paying attention to the concerns. Again, Florida is a great example. The prosecutors in Florida were standing up and saying, don't do this. Don't give immunity to people. And yet the legislature chose to do it. But because the legislature chose to do it, the short answer to your question is it can go back to the legislature and it can certainly be fixed.
So the castle doctrine comes from the notion that your home is your castle. And,
that is correct.
And then there's another doctrine, which has been in the law for a long time, which is the duty to retreat. And it seems like this stand your ground law has superseded the duty for the retreat. In other words, you don't ask for trouble, right?
That is correct. And with the idea of stand your ground, is there an opportunity? It's not that with stand your ground, going back to the common law doctrine, that you always had a duty to retreat, but if you had an opportunity to retreat, you should do so.
So in law enforcement, I would think that professionals like yourself and professional police would be very dubious of these kind of amateur vigilante types, these kind of wannabe cops, which clearly Mr. Zimmerman in this case, because he's some news reports have suggested he's called into 911 hundreds of times. At the very least, he's overzealous. But according to the tape that was released, and now there's some controversy over to whether there are racist comments within the tape and whether there are more versions of the tape. I'm not quite sure where that stands. But the long and the short of it is, it's pretty clear that this guy, to some extent, was almost an imagining of a crime, and without going into any sort of amateur psychiatrics here, I'm of the understanding that this kind of activity is totally screened out with police departments, and that they're trained professionally to act with restraint.
I will join and say absolutely. Starting from the police angle, if this had been a police shooting, it would have required that there, and the police officer would only have what we call qualified immunity, meaning that the officer would need to prove that during the course and scope of his duty, he or she was faced with imminent and, you know, likely death and responded to that and responded appropriately. However, you know, and like you, we don't know a lot of the facts of the case, but some of the facts seem to be beyond question. One of them being this individual, this killer, was on the neighborhood watch. And when he went on the neighborhood watch, he brought his handgun with him. And obviously in this situation, yes, he did. He called 911 and said, you know, there's an intruder. That's part of their statute, that he saw an individual go into a carport or go around a residence, and it was a gated community, and so he is responding to that intruder and going to confront the intruder. My understanding of the 911 call is the 911 operator was telling him, you know, please wait for the authorities to arrive. Hand it to the professionals. Don't act on your own. Yet he chose to do it, and he took a life.
Well, it's also, though, that he apparently he pretty much nominated himself for the job. But the fact that he had a handgun, apparently that is not a crime in Florida, carrying a concealed weapon.
Absolutely. Not only is it not a crime, he apparently had whatever the certification was to carry that weapon.
So
I'm not suggesting for a moment that he was unlawfully carrying that weapon. I'm putting forward to you that carrying that weapon carries a tremendous amount of responsibility.
Well, that's why they train police, isn't it? Isn't that why? And that this fellow may not even have met the qualifications for private security by the sound of it.
Does not sound like it to me either.
So tell me from a prosecutor's point of view, David Lebon, because my understanding is that the prosecutors down in Florida They opposed this law from the beginning, as you did. And I believe when you were head of the California Deputy Attorneys Association, you worked to prevent that law from coming into effect here in California, right?
That is correct. I should say there was one state that was successful beating it back, and that was the great state of California. That we knew in 2005 it was coming and successfully defeated it in the legislature, yes. But other states were not so fortunate.
32 other states.
Yes.
So, but in Florida, my understanding is that what's happening now is that gangs are using this law to protect themselves out from shooting each other over what gang wars or drug deals, etc. I mean, it's become a nightmare for prosecutors.
Yes, as we've already suggested, there were an average now of since the law's been passed, 33 killings per year, and there have been not. Chances, you speak about the prosecutors there, they're called state's attorneys. State's attorneys have even in some cases tried to move forward, and the courts have dismissed the actions. So it's very clear that there is immunity. As you mentioned, gang members, you think about, and unfortunately, lots of confrontations between gang members happen on streets. One gang member sees another gang member with a gun and shoots him dead. There isn't that, especially if there is some relationship to it being a residence or property or occupied vehicle is contained within the Florida statute. They can make an argument that they were responding and protecting and had no duty, as you said, to retreat. They can go ahead and shoot somebody dead. They cannot be prosecuted. In fact, they cannot even be arrested. The statute's very specific on that.
But what does one make of the police behavior in terms of, and it's not all clear at this point, in terms of when they got to the scene? First of all, they kept trying to restrain this fellow from going after the kid. That's clear from the tapes. You know, they told him to back off, but he obviously didn't listen. But when they got there, apparently he was standing over the body of the boy. He claims to have got into a struggle with the boy. The other witnesses seem to refute that, but the press reports indicate that the police were coaching all the witnesses and the killer to stick with the self-defense scenario. Why would they do that?
That I do not know. I had understood from some of the accounts, and again, I have no first-hand knowledge, but my understanding was that they had arrested him, put him in handcuffs, and I believe even put him in the back of a police car, and then later at some point released him, but did release him there at the scene. I don't know about the coaching.
So he was initially arrested, according to your understanding?
My understanding was, yes.
And then what do you think intervened to release him then?
Well, what intervened is the Florida statute gives civil and criminal immunity, and in addition to that, if someone is accused, they, and I'm trying to reach here for the statute itself, the individual, if they are, quote, wrongfully accused, gets to collect attorney's fees and damages and all sorts of things
against
the state.
I see. The state had a motive to cut him loose. I'm afraid
not only a motive, that they knew they would be threatened,
right,
and have a possible lawsuit if they did not release him.
Sure. Well, we've run out of time, and I thank you so much for joining us here, David LeBon.
Sure.
Again, David LeBon is the president and CEO of the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys, a national association representing elected and deputy and assistant prosecutors and city attorneys. He was previously the executive director of the California District Attorneys Association. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.